Lincoln Lights get hold of technology and science, and we're delighted now to feature Professor Carenza Lewis, Professor, of course, for the public understanding of research at the University of Lincoln, and indeed, no pun intended, leading light behind leading Lincoln Lights. How are you, Carenza?
I'm very well, thank you.
Let's share with the listener who will be kind of aware of this. I mean, certainly there's the Facebook page, there's the Twitter feed, there's a whole variety of other factors. Let's talk a little bit about Lincoln Get Hold of Technology and Science and how it fits into what really is becoming an annual September festival of scientific wonders.
Yes, absolutely. We had the first one last year. This one is carrying on this year. And it's actually a Europe-wide festival. So it's part of European Researchers Night. There are universities across the continent opening up on the same day to give members of the public a chance to find out about research that's going on in their midst, what's been discovered and why it's important and interesting.
Now, already we've been privileged to actually speak to a range of the contributors. Again, the sort of mini podcasts from the genius behind Mark the Robot, the whole notions of caring and attitudes and so on. There's literally a wealth of experience. It's almost that all human life is going to be paraded from a sort of scientific perspective within Lincoln Lights.
Yes, I mean, I defy anyone really who comes along not to find something that's of interest, because although it's focused on science and technology, that's such a wide field, and it's really just about knowledge. So there's everything from the historical consultant to the film Suffragettes a few years ago, right through to, as you say, robots and physics and proton beam therapy, medicine, with everything in between, really.
I was quite pleased to see that slot takes place at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. in the Minerva building through a glass darkly is attracting one or two sort of likes on Facebook, which is quite nice.
Well, yes, Alex, I think that'll be very popular as your own contribution. But again, it's about the relationship between science fiction and real science and how that informs, how ideas become reality and reality becomes ideas. And that's really interesting. People are, interested to know what's the truth, but how much of what you see in the films could actually be real, and how does that affect society? So yes, I think those are going to be really good sessions.
Well, the interrelationship, I think, between the imagination and the imagineering world is something which, again, has been very much the fore ever since Konstantin Tsiolkovsky was actually building his first rocket ships.
As people who come along to your talk will find out.
Let's move more on to the general nature of the festival and that wonderful word legacy, which sometimes often people tend to use illness as a pejorative, but actually this is something which, as we head into the end of the second, beginning of the third decade of the 21st century, into the future, it can often be sort of exciting times, frightening times, etc. This is a real chance to actually inspire people to get involved with, of course, those STEM subjects, science, technology, education, media, and mathematics.
Yes, I think it's, we've got 1,000 school children coming along, we've got members of the public will be coming along. And I think for people who, the world can often seem a very busy place and there's an awful lot going on that you don't quite understand or quite know very much about, and it just seems everything's very out of control. So just coming on along and finding out how real people are working on real ideas that really make a difference and how we ourselves could get involved in that. So for school students who come along, there's their whole future to think about. I'd love them to get inspired by something of what they see going on, that they can take part in, realise that knowledge and discovery isn't for other people. Other people are all of us. People who make discoveries are just like all of us, and anybody who comes along to Lights could be someone who makes a discovery.
And looking at the overall range that we've got here, from skeletons in the cupboard, myths and science of sleep, the building blocks of food, I realise it might be asking the equivalent of an author to choose between their favourite books or a parent to choose between their favourite offspring. Which ones are you, if we were to actually step aside from your role as a coordinator and genius behind the whole thing, which ones would appeal to yourself?
Well, as you say, it is a bit like asking someone to choose between their favourite children. I think the ones on sleep, I think, will be very interesting, because that's something we all struggle with from time to time. And nobody really knows why humans need sleep anyway. But we do. Obviously, I'm an archaeologist, so I'm particularly interested in the more archaeological ones, so the ones on history. I think the display on the 3D printing and the terracotta army and the way that that new technology can both help conserve something like the terracotta army, all those huge ceramic statues that were found in China, but also can help us sort of understand how we can even design new. Every single one is individual of those terracotta warriors. How did they do that? You know, it's difficult enough for us to do it with computer technology. And you can actually see them being printed out and see how that technology helps understand. So that's interesting. The skeletons in the cupboard, I think, is good. There is something about, I think if I had my time again, I'd do human remains.
Well, I'm sure that actually, with respect to time travel, clearly, Carenza, you will have your time again and we'll just go around in a whole range of circles. But that's another philosophical
will
aspect.
Will I have the knowledge to make the decisions differently?
Sure, get that sorted through. Interesting enough, John Murray, I know when we were talking about his involvement with respect to 3D printing as well, the 3D Forge interested me because, again, that whole notion of it's being produced almost rather like the, I suppose the old alchemists would say, it's magic. It's being produced and made from this whole round of things. And yet people are actually able to engage in the virtual forge, engage in, as you say, a 3D terracotta army. It's quite, before too long, I'm sure they'll have 3D academics as well.
Well, we try to be very multidimensional all the time. Yes, there's a lot, really. I mean, you know, there's going to be lots of displays, lots of stands, lots of exhibitions. People can come and look. They can have a hands-on go. There's a sports performance demonstration showing how instant biofeedback, you know, information about how you're performing and how you're positioning your body can tell you how effectively you're working. You know, it's a very physically engaged sort of thing. So it's not just about sort of sitting down and listening to a talk. You can do that, then you can go off and do something a bit more physical and active. And a lot of what people will be doing actually contributes to the research. So we'll be collecting data from is it dangerous, the text as you're walking along, for example. People can come and find out whether they're safe to text while they're walking along and whether other people are.
Absolutely. And I know that our sports science people are also offering various ways to actually improve performance, which is great stuff there. Lightsexpo.org is the best website to go to find out details about the whole scenario. Let's talk about costs. The magical thing is there really isn't any for the public.
No, all the events of activities are free. It's funded by the European Commission, so the costs are all covered. All people need to do is get themselves here, they might want to buy themselves a coffee or refreshments.
Yes.
We can't provide those,
but
it's all free.
What better way to actually celebrate the end of September 2017 than actually with a totally free event to actually be enlightened, be illuminated, and elucidated with respect to Lincoln Lights?
Yes, I think, you know, on a Friday, you come along with your school, you'll have an amazing day finding out stuff that you never knew about the world that really makes a difference. Come along as a member of the public, perhaps after work, you can come and sort of have a relaxing sit down, listen to a talk, have a look round some exhibitions and some demonstrations, grab a coffee, have another lecture, and then final look at another exhibition. Yeah, lovely way to end the day.
Absolutely. And let's talk social media to wrap up with, in terms of Facebook, in terms of Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest and so on. The best way to actually stay in touch and keep appraised of what's happening with respect to Lincoln Lights, obviously safely, depending on whether you're texting at the same time, etc. Facebook addresses, presumably they're all on the lightsexpo.org.
Yes, the Facebook page, Twitter, follow Twitter.
And we'd encourage people to share as well.
Absolutely, share it again, because there may be things that you can't make yourself, but other people might be interested. And the difficult thing with starting something like this is getting the word out there. After last year, the number of people who said, oh, I'd love to have come along to that, but I didn't know about it. We're doing our best to get the message out there. So if anyone hears anything about it and thinks, oh, I know someone who might be interested, or even just repost it, retweet it, so that anybody out there on your networks and their networks beyond that, somebody you don't even know may think, oh, I live near Lincoln, I'll pop into that.
Lincoln, get hold of tech and science. It's Lincoln Lights. So we've reached the stage where we're talking CSI, not necessarily crime scene investigation, although, who knows, possibly CSI Seal. With fingerprints from the past, we're delighted to be able to welcome to this series of podcast previews, as far as Lincoln Lights is concerned, the fantastically talented, amazing, wonderful Philippa Hoskin. Good to connect with you as ever, Philippa.
Hello.
Philippa, share with us this whole notion of what you've been doing with fingerprints from the past, because it seems fascinating. Working with the Imprint Project team, developing a whole variety of things, etc. Just break it down for us, please.
Right, yes. Imprint is an AHRC-funded project between the University of Lincoln and the University of Aberystwyth, where we're using forensic techniques to look at medieval prints on the back of wax seals. So when you impress your matrix, your sort of die, into your medieval wax seal to put on the bottom of your land grant, maybe, or other agreement. On the back, you often left a finger or a palm print, just incidentally, in the soft wax. And as the wax hardens, that gets left behind. Now, we want to think about what we can find out about those prints. So our forensic team are helping us to look at those and to see where we can see the same print across more than one seal, where we see different prints that might also be really interesting, maybe different prints on the backs of versions of the same matrix, so by the same person. And we're also thinking about lots of other things about how people actually made medieval wax, how people performed sealing, what that tells us about what people were thinking and about social networks, people's different ideas about how they fitted into society.
We're talking about something which clearly is 700-800 years old in terms of duration. So a lot of circuits around the Earth, around the Sun, and various other factors. Have there been any surprises in terms of what you've discovered from the scenarios? Anything that which you thought, oh, that's interesting?
Well, we've seen some really interesting individual items. We have managed to see, for example, a seal of Bishop Hugh of Lincoln with a print on the back. And we're looking for more sealed copies of his seal because, of course, he's a saint. If we're lucky, because Hugh was known for being involved in his own document production, unusually so, it's written into his saint's life, then maybe we've actually got his print on the back, and that would be really exciting to see. We've also seen occasions when we can see how connected people are to their seals. A seal, if you're a small landowner, person of not very much status in society, that might be the only individual thing you own where you made a choice about what writing was going to be around the edge, about what image was going to be in the middle. And we can see examples of how people change those seals. There's a young woman in Lincoln who makes changes from her very simple seal when she's about 16 and does her first ever document to a very much more sophisticated one 10 years later when she is actually making some quite sharp land deals. She's moved up. And we can also see people who are desperate for their seal to stay the same. So even we can tell when they lose a seal or break a matrix, they go and have something made that's almost exactly the same because they want it to be about them. And we've also been able to do some work with things like the temperature wax, medieval wax, would have had to be for you to be able to put your matrix in, take it out, not so soft you lose the image, not so hard you can't do it, and how complicated and difficult that might be, and how that might tell us something about the expertise needed to do that.
Now, those of us who follow the CSI series are well aware of the way in which science is used to discover all sorts of things, all amazing within 42 minutes usually, which is amazing. Clearly, this is a lot longer in terms of the ways forward. But in terms of using those forensic techniques, have you used things like gas, liquid, chromatography? Are we looking at other areas within the field?
What we've got is an amazing piece of equipment. It's called a crime light imager, and it's actually a piece of equipment that forensic scientists take out into the field. And basically it works with the whole spectrum of light. So you can put whatever item it is that you're working with into the machine, under the different lights, and we can use the whole spectrum to look at it, to see where we get the best images, to shift it around and see what we get at different angles. And then when we're happy that we've got the best image we capture it on a screen, on the computer screen where we can look at it. And those are the images that forensic scientists use. That's what they work with.
So looking towards the workshop event, because clearly at the heart of Lincoln Lights is to expose the fabulous work that's being done across the university and beyond to the general public. And you mentioned, obviously, AHRC funding, in case people are wondering. Is that another four-letter acronym? It's Arts Humanities Research Council, just
that's
to make it,
it
quite
yes.
clear. But in terms of that, what can people expect from your good self, Professor Hoskin?
Well, what we're going to be doing is showing you how people actually made the medieval wax. So we're working with some medieval wax recipes in conservation, and we'll make up some wax there. Then we're going to be showing you how people actually sealed it, how they held the wax, how they put the matrix in and removed it, so you can see how the prints got there. We'll also have our fancy piece of equipment, our crime light imager there, so we'll be able to show you how that works, the sorts of material things that we might find from it, and we'll bring some of our results and talk to you about what we're already beginning to find.
And in terms of the legal aspects, clearly we're looking, as you mentioned there, about property and endorsing aspects and so on. For folk who are sort of thinking, is it going to be like Brother Cadwyle then? Are we going to see elements within that? I think it's fair to say we're not really dealing with murder cases here, are we, really, I suppose? Or was a seal the sort of final jurisdiction that was put on in terms of when final decisions were made?
No, but there are two interesting things that are arising from the material. One of them might be connected to murder, might be. The first, in terms of medieval crime, is forgery. People forge documents. For example, there's one document at Westminster Abbey, where we went to spend some time, and that purports to be an 11th century document making a grant to the Abbey, but it's got a seal on the bottom, and no one puts seals on in the 11th century. It's really quite a good forgery apart from that. We think it's a late 12th century sort forgery. What we have, though, are lots of prints all over the back of that seal. So we're working with our forensic experts at the moment to compare the prints on that to prints on other late 12th century seals we've got and see whether we can find any matches or if it's maybe a bit later. So we might be able to sort of solve that forgery case.
Just goes to show there's always an opportunity to be caught, even 800 years later.
Absolutely. The other thing is we're going to help people get caught now as well. Fingerprints are amazing things, but we're used to thinking that they're unique. And there is no actual evidence yet, no statistical evidence that they are completely unique. So we're going to give some of our prints. Our forensic experts work with the Home Office a lot, and they're going to use some of our prints to add to the sort of database and material that they're using, modern material, to try and strengthen that statistical evidence. Mm.
That sounds slightly worrying in many ways, right, from that perspective. Presumably we need to be heading on to the biometrics such as retina scans and voice prints before too long. Where is this going to be heading off to? Because clearly, I mean, there's so many exciting things that which you've already discovered by using these forensic techniques and so on. Is it something where you can apply more contemporary technology to finding out more about the past?
Well, when we have worked with the forensic scientists on this particular level of the imagery, they're also going to put the images through some more technical equipment. So we may be able to get better matches and better equipment. So we'll be able to build with that. But really, this is all, we're increasingly finding that this is about identity, about how people are connected or not connected to this thing that's a bit like a signature and a bit like a credit card, if you like, that grants land, that you put on the bottom of your documents, and how the administration or the bureaucracy of document development and document writing was changing in the 13th and 14th century. So those are the ideas we're going to feed into.
And clearly, in the 13th century and so on, we were still, at least Britain, working with Europe. Were there any kind of differences across the continent as far as you can actually tell, or has the focus of the research been primarily on the British state of affairs?
Well, whilst the focus of this project has been primarily on Britain, we are actually working with our colleagues in Germany and Belgium and France, who are also very excited. For example, our colleagues in Germany are finding seals where instead of just finding prints on the back that look as though they're incidental, they're finding places where people push their fingers very deliberately into the wax. And we're looking at some examples in Britain that might do the same sorts of things, and that's enabling us to think about different ways people might be saying, I was here, I was involved.
for people who are listening to this at present, apart from signing up for Lincoln Lights, because there are so many good things that are actually there, how can people find out more details about your own research, Professor Hoskin, and also other sort of areas to maybe get involved with this whole aspect?
Well, they can certainly go and look at our Twitter feed, Imprint Project, and they can go from there to our blog and see what we're doing. And we put up information about cases we find, other sorts of research we've been doing, some of the scientific material we've been working with. And by the end of this year, there will also be a full website as well, where they'll be able to see some of our results too.
Lincoln, get hold of tech and science. It's Lincoln Lights. With the research interests that include virtual reality, education, training and simulation, technologies for teaching and pedagogy, and, of course, cognitive biases for personality and interaction in robotics, clearly Lincoln Lights would not have been Lincoln Lights without featuring the fantastic principal lecturer, Dr. John Murray. Good to connect with you, John. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are yourself?
Very good indeed. Now, I just want to clarify something before we progress. You are not an android. You are the human original John Murray.
I am,
that's
yes.
Okay, because you never know.
I was tempted to send an android in my place, but decided I should come.
Okay, excellent. We've got two wonderful things we're going to talk about. So we've got two separate little podcasts for this. And the first one that we're going to focus on is this whole notion of the virtual blacksmith forge. Now, initially I thought, is that an oxymoron? Is that something where we're taking the wonderful sort of farrier technique of shoeing horses and so on back in the day and putting it into virtual reality? Share with us, John, what is it about?
So it all started a few years ago. I was approached by the curator of a museum in Spalding, the Chainbridge Forge, who had an interest in technology and likes to use technology to showcase history and how blacksmithing used to be in the olden days. So we got together, we had a chat about how we could use the expertise of the university and technology and support the Chainbridge Forge in Spalding to see how we could teach young children, the new generation of people, about heritage and history, and particularly blacksmithing. So we were funded by the Heritage Lottery Fund. They gave us a nice little grant of about £40,000 to take this forward. And the idea is that you have a virtual reality headset, you pop this on, and you're transported into a virtual world which is reminiscent of a blacksmith. You've got the fire in front of you, you've got your anvil, you've got all your tools. And the idea is that you use these tools in virtual reality, you create an artifact, you heat your metal up in the fire, you put coal on it, virtual coal, and the fire gets hotter, and you've got your hammer and all your little tools, and you can chisel away and bang away and create an artifact. And we thought, this is fantastic, this is great. So we've got the artifact, we've created it virtually, what can we do with it now? So we combined that with 3D printing technology. So using a 3D printer, once you've created your artifact in virtual reality, you 3D print it. So you actually do have a memento to take away of the artifact that you've created virtually.
Back in flesh world, I know that at the Yorkshire Agricultural Society, when we've covered the Great Yorkshire Show and so on, they were very excited with the real forge that they've actually got there. But I can see this as something which really could be a wonderful companion piece and also keep the art of blacksmithing alive into the 21st and probably even 22nd centuries.
Well, this is it. You know, so I remember when I was a child at school and we used to do day trips away. We went to boat museums and we actually went to a blacksmith as well. But they're so few and far between now, it's very difficult for many schools to be able to take their pupils to an actual blacksmith museum and see how it works. So what we thought was, by having this system, we can take this to schools. We can take it out to the schools and we can show them in a way that children understand today. It's all about games, consoles and computers and technology. So we thought, let's combine these. Let's combine the history, the heritage, in a modern way that the children understand. So we've taken this out to a number of schools, number of events, and it's been really well received. And the idea is obviously that it's safer. You know, you've got no real fire there. It's a bit more fun. You know, you can play about. You can do things you wouldn't normally be able to do in an actual blacksmith forge as well. So you can unleash a new area of creativity about the artifacts that you can create. And obviously with the 3D printing, you can actually still take something away from it as well.
One of the aspects about virtual reality, of course, is it's an immersive technology, or can be an immersive technology. You actually enter this whole routine. Back in the day, those of us who are chronologically gifted can remember The Lawnmower Man and Stephen King and aspects relating to that. And then lastly, of course, The Matrix and Nation of Reality and so on. In this particular instance, of course, you've got 3D printing, you've got virtual reality headset technology. So is it a way of actually getting a classic synergy? You've got two disparate things that are coming together really to create that whole experience.
It is, yes. So obviously I remember The Lawnmower Man as well, kind of technology. And we looked at that. We thought, oh, this is never going to be, never going
to
happen.
Pierce Brosnan went on to do Bond. It was a different thing entirely.
Yeah, totally different. But it actually is very immersive. You know, I'm not sure if you've tried virtual reality, but on the Lights Festival, come along, have a go.
Well, I think you convinced me. I have tried the Oculus Rift, which I thought was an astounding piece. And whether it was wandering through the Starship Enterprise decks or indeed taking the up and down slide thing, I thought that was quite interesting. And also quite disorienting. I felt that was one of the aspects about it. You did not that I suffer from vertigo, but there was that sort of slight sense of nausea coming across.
With the Oculus, so we built the first prototype for the system with the Oculus, and we had lots of trouble with the Oculus because it doesn't have tracking on the actual headset, so you can the headset can drift in the virtual space and it gives you that sense of motion sickness. But we're now using the HTC Vive, which is again another level beyond Oculus. People who have experienced motion sickness on the Oculus have experienced none whatsoever on the Vive. Tracking,
so I wasn't alone there.
Lots of people have experienced that. But on the Vive, it's so much better, and the immersivity is unbelievable. And with sound, so we've got all the noise in the background of hammers and chisels banging away, it just adds that extra sense of realism to take it to that world.
And of course, with the 3D printing, presumably we're getting to that whole aspect of genuinely producing artifacts from the virtual world and then having something to take home with you.
Well, this is it. So what we're looking at, obviously this is not the end of the project. You know, we're looking at how we can take other heritage crafts forward. So we're looking at sculpting, you know, so hammer and chisel kind of technology, and being able to create artifacts using that and 3D printing. But the next step is manufacture. So in a virtual world, you don't need big factories with all the big heavy machinery. In a virtual world, you create the item you need. Use your virtual miller, your virtual router, your virtual lathe, create an artifact, and then print it, and you have a mold to create the actual metal version, or you can now get 3D printers that will print in metal as well.
We've already talked about the safety aspects. Presumably this also applies to the perception of ecological aspects. You're not actually getting all that kind of contamination of the environment that you get from a genuine blacksmith's forge. It's magic, isn't it, John?
It is. It is definitely
that
magic.
Arthur C. Clarke scenario, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. This is it in action, isn't it?
It is. I remember virtual reality when it started back in the 90s, and a lot of companies were getting excited by virtual reality. But you compare that with
it was clunky.
Even the visualization of it, the graphics were just so blocky and basic. And you were in a virtual world, but you knew you were not actually in that place. There's been a number
wasn't
of
even as good as Tron. Let's be honest.
Well, it is. I mean, there's been a number of occasions that I've been using this Vive headset and I've forgotten where I am, you know, and my partner's come in and touched me on the shoulder to tell me that dinner's ready, and I've jumped out my body and thought, who was that? What's going on? I'm not actually in this virtual world. I am stood in my living room.
People have said the same about the University of Lincoln, of course, but I won't go any further. Nobody's tapped me on the shoulder as yet, and it's been over 20 years, so there we are. I mean, it sounds absolutely wonderful. Let's go back to Lincoln Lights itself, of course. People have the opportunity to obviously see the virtual blacksmith in action, and presumably go away with stuff.
They do. They have the opportunity to come along, have a play, try it out, see what they think, and 3D prints an artifact that they've made.
And for people who are listening to this online, in their own virtual world, and maybe they're not able to get to Lincoln, maybe they're in different countries, they're globally connected from that point of view, what's the best resource online you would suggest to go to find out more about what we've been talking about in this little segment, focusing on the virtual blacksmith?
So on the computer science blog pages, which is socks.blogs.lincoln.ac.uk, there are a number of news stories, videos that have been produced about this. We've had a number of BBC news articles as well published about the technology. And just a quick Google search will reveal.
I can only eulogise about the impact that science is having here. Have you had any criticism from people saying, but what about the real art and the dirt of the whole system? Isn't this taking away from the craft?
It does, but the counter to that is it's never going to replace the craft. We're not trying to replace the craft. What we're trying to do is excite new people about the craft and get them interested about it and say, look, you know, there is this history, this other craft that you might not know about. Instead of sitting in front of TV playing on games consoles, use that technology to learn about real crafts and then get involved in those real crafts. So with the actual Chainbridge Forge in Spalding, we do a number of events. We've done a few weeks ago where we take the virtual blacksmith and we take a portable forge as well, so you can have a go with the virtual and a go with the real and see how they differ and how they have synergies as well.
Dr. John Murray, for the moment, many thanks indeed, and keep hammering that blacksmith.
Thank you very much.
The Happiness Lab. In its own way, it just says so much, just those three words, and actually we're delighted to talk about this in terms of Lincoln Lights by discussing the matter of the Happiness Lab with the founder, the general originator, the all-round superlative individual who is Professor Roger Brotherton. Good morning, Roger.
Hello, good morning. How are you doing?
Delighted to touch base with a good self. Now, we all like to be happy, we presume, unless you've got a misanthropic line on the whole system and somehow you kind of reverse the scenario. But this particular thing in terms of making an interactive multimedia course which offers insight, I mean, the NHS, all of these kind of things about, you know, how we as human beings are happy.
Yeah, that's right. And probably the first thing to say, I mean, I didn't originate the thing, so I'm a contributor. I'm part of a team of people who gave to this, and it was put together by a company called the Ugly Duckling Company, who effectively said it would be really good to have a very easily accessible course that actually drew on the science of what it means to be happy. So there's an enormous amount of science done over the last 15 years on what makes life worth living, meaningful, enjoyable, things like that. And so the course includes me, psychologists, psychiatrists, faith leaders, doctors, a couple of GPs in there. And so it's all about what do we know right now about how we can be happy and find well-being.
Looking over the 20th century, clearly dopamine is used in terms of those are the chemical stimulants that when we jog, for instance, that kind of fires off, etc. Timothy Leary, of course, had his line in terms of tune in, turn on, drop out. We wouldn't advocate that for all clear reasons. Over the centuries, people have always had different aspects. I mean, you know, from the philosophers of Socrates and Plato's time, in terms of how do we get to happiness. David Cameron, dare I say it, was also talking about the big society and the happiness and so on. And yet, can you quantify it? Is it trying to quantify the qualitative? Are we into that challenge of saying we can actually, you know, say on a scale of 1 to 10, Likert scale, you're a 9 or a 3 or a 4, whatever?
Well, obviously, as a psychologist, I would say yes, we can. Yes, we can measure it. And actually, interesting, I mean, you mentioned David Cameron, but David Cameron was actually it was sort of influenced by the very psychologist that this draws on, really. So people we would call positive psychologists. And they've really been studying what are the habits, the practices, those kind of things that make things worth doing. And when the maths is done on happiness, what we seem to discover is about 50% of our overall sense of well-being is in our genes. So some people are just more cheerful than others at birth. That's the way it works. About 10% is our circumstances. So, you know, how you know, relative poverty and things like that. But about 40% of it seems to be based on what our attitudes, our behaviours, our psychology. And so as a psychologist, that's the bit I'm really interested in, is what can we do with that 40% of our own practices that can actually lead to a level of happiness?
NLP is another three-letter acronym that often emerges and tends to polarise people. Yep. You know, you think neuro-linguistic programming, you know, it's all new age material and so on. And yet, from one's own empirical observations, and I'm coming to it more as a kind of chemist and a biologist in terms of the background, if you actually have somebody who's constantly looking on the negative side, they tend to get more negative.
Correct, yes.
And vice versa, if they're being positive, even though you might sort of think, is that a Pollyanna syndrome? Are you into that system, as you said, in the genes? Then actually, in some way, shape or form, there's a connection that works there. Yeah. Unless, of course, they're lying and they're actually externally, everything's fine. Inside, they're bleeding to bits, basically. but is that also something which, again, in terms of our human nature, is it impacts into the into this happiness lab.
Yeah. So one of the things that the happiness lab does over 6 weeks, effectively, it's six sessions, it's multimedia, it's that side of things, and it picks up some of the science. So it talks about how, for example, grateful people, when we do research on gratitude and we get people doing gratitude diaries, their levels of well-being, happiness, physical exercise, health, even things like longevity are affected. By things like gratitude, like kindness. For example, people who are more forgiving tend to suffer less from heart disease and things like that. And people who invest well in their relationships, that kind of social support, leads to all kinds of great outcomes, particularly reduces things like depression and anxiety and stuff like that. And physical exercise too. So, you know, if you're out there exercising, it's one of the best things you can possibly do. I mean, you talked about the dopamine hit. It's one of the best things you can possibly do around building things like discipline and perspective. And, you know, even a 15-minute brisk walk can be enough to significantly lift your mood.
Mm-hmm. So this is an interactive multimedia course that is being offered across the country. How are we going to compress that? How are you going to develop it for Lincoln Lights? What are we going to see? What's the average sort of thinking? I quite fancy finding a bit more about the public-facing side of science and the university, etc. What are people going to see?
It's great. So for Lincoln Lights, what I'm going to do is I'm basically going to pick up my favourite bits, really, of the Happiness Lab. We'll show
digest.
We'll show some of the content. And we'll play with some of the ideas. So some of the exercises like gratitude, like kindness, like forgiveness, things like that, can actually be presented pretty simply and pretty quickly, show the science, have a play with it, see what people make of it. And the thing about this is, I mean, like a lot of things, happiness can't be forced. There's nothing worse than the idea of happiness being imposed on us. It's a very oppressive idea. So this will be an invitation. It's kind of come, have a go, see what you make of it, see what kind of fits, what doesn't fit. And so it's going to be a lot of fun. It'll be humorous. It'll be interactive. I'm quite happy to have people come and disagree with me, so you don't have to come and think it's all fantastic. So it's kind of just taking the basics of the Happiness Lab and taking that time to talk through them and look at them.
Culturally, are there differences that can be seen between, again, historically, America is often seen as a very positive pace, although, again, that's changed recently. Yeah. And equally, you've got the stiff upper lip that we manifest, obviously, in Britain, and we shouldn't show our emotions and all. Are those stereotypes that kind of emerged?
Some findings like that are a bit spurious. You know how there's theories like Germans have a no sense of humour and British people. Yeah, those kind of things. Well, those things appear not to be true. But there are some differences, for example, between America and Europe. One of them is when you measure hope across America and Europe, Americans seem to be very hopeful, can do, things will happen, there is a better future ahead of us. Europeans, not quite so much. but then if you take something like religiosity, for example, America tends to be much more religious than Europe is. And even in America, if you measure religion by sort of longitude, where are people in the country north to south, they get more religious as it goes more south. So there's kind of quite a few differences like that.
And that, presumably, Roger, is again another potential hot potato, because when you get into religiosity, are you talking about, well, the Western Christianized religions? Are we talking about Islamic faith? Are we talking about Buddhism, which many people say it's not a faith at all, it's a state of being and so on? Again, it's interesting how many people get very passionate about wellness, really. Say, no, our secret to happiness is this.
Yeah, and what's interesting about this kind of science is that it's taken from all of that. So it's really looked through all time, right back to Buddha, Jesus, Aristotle, all those kind of sources, and said, what are the unifying themes in all of this? So all of them, to some extent, talk about kindness, or they talk about compassion, they talk about hope, they talk about good social engagement with other people.
See, the flip side, if you tried it with Nietzsche, you'd have nihilism personified. That's which, I suppose, is another form of happiness, but the reverse, the anti-happiness.
Well, the interesting thing with nihilism is, generally speaking, so for example, there's research done on nihilism where they stick people in a waiting room and they measure their degree of nihilism. And they see what they do in a waiting room. And the more nihilistic people are, the less exploratory behavior they show just when left in a waiting room. So there is some science that what nihilism is good at is good at kind of being realistic. So it stops us having false hope. But as a consequence of that, it also shuts us down to genuine hope in terms of genuinely believing something good can happen.
And I'm mindful of the John Cleese line in Clockwise, it's the hope that kills you. He doesn't mind the despair, but it's the hope that's the
difference. That's right.
In terms of finding online material for folk who are listening to this and they're accessing it from different countries, different areas, wherever, where's the best place or which websites would you recommend they should actually check out, Roger?
So the Ugly Duckling website actually has a great bit on the Happiness Lab. But actually, if you put the Happiness Lab into Google, just those words, you'll get the two Vimeo promos pop up. So you'll be able to see me talking about it. And there's also a lovely one-minute promo on there that just gives you a sense of what it is. You can find out more. You can see the original pilot group of people who did it. So it's quite a nice presentation, and it'll give you everything you need from there.
Do you know, I feel we could actually always use these 10-minute podcasts as another way of making people happy. I just feel better already. Work our way through that. You're coming expecting all sorts of things, and it's there. The happiness.
There we go.
It does work. Roger Bratherton, many thanks indeed. Lincoln, get hold of tech and science. It's Lincoln Lights. No disassemble, and indeed Rossum's Universal Robots, to juxtapose a couple of texts that emerged from the danger, danger, warning Will Robinson aspect, in which people have notions about what they mean by robots and so on. And to address this in collaboration, obviously, with Lincoln Lights, because it's a key aspect, and we're delighted to welcome back Dr. John Murray, Principal Lecturer and Programme Leader, of course, in the School of Computer Science. John, as ever, a delight.
Hello, thank you very much.
So, here we are. Mark has become almost a mini superstar at the University of Lincoln, hasn't he?
You find him around, his picture here
exactly.
And there. He likes the camera, that's for sure.
Exactly. And tapping into that notion of, I've cited obviously some of my own robotic idols, if you like, the notions of the Lost in Space, Robbie the Robot. Of course, going back to Forbidden Planet, the original sort of version there. Plus, of course, we've got androids and the difference between robots and androids. And don't get me started on Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Does Mark, by the way? Have you not asked him?
Never asked him.
There we are. But this is something where we're seeing both humans anthropomorphising robots, which is what we tend to do. But also the other notion, which I think you're also very keen in, how robots can act as carers, as assistants, can actually be part of improving the human experience.
Yeah. So MARC, Multi-Actuated Robotic Companion, I like my acronyms, is part of an open source project. So he's a 3D printed robot, and anyone can download the designs and you can print your own companion and have your own personal robot. But yeah, what we're interested in, what we were looking at with this robot, is the fact that it was, humanoid in features, and it moves very similar to how a human moves. It has the same degrees of freedom in its hands and its arms and its head and all these kinds of things. And we were looking at how people accept these kinds of robots and how people relate to them as objects, as companions, as friends. So we were looking at cognitive bias, and we were seeing whether people preferred robots that were perfect. So, if you look at Star Trek and see Lieutenant Commander Data, he started off being very, in his personality, very what we define as robotic, no emotion, didn't understand humour or jokes. Pinocchio, exactly.
How easily humans go that can whistle.
and this Data, as he developed through as we got to know him, he became more likeable, more personable, and one of the starring characters of the show. And it's that kind of relationship I'm interested in, between how people relate to these robots and how we can, include them in our culture.
In many ways, John, you can be the Noonien Singh of the University of Lincoln in terms of the Data connection. Of course, he did have an emotional chip, I think, that also kind of impacted in terms of...
Later on, they installed the
emotional chip from that line. There is this fear on one hand. I mean, Asimov, possibly with his three laws of robotics, is one of the founding lights when it comes to robots and how they can be not seen as a threat, because there is that classic schlock horror science fiction scenario of the robots are invading the death rays and so on and so forth. From what you've described there, they're more than tools, clearly, on the one hand. But on the other hand, where do we actually position our own sort of existence as biochemical life forms and that whole thing? It's almost back to Data and Measure of a Man, really.
Well, this is it. I mean, if you, don't believe in a soul and an afterlife for humans, we are just machines. We function, we have chemical reactions that go on inside our brains that make us do things, very much like a computer program in a robot makes the robot do things. But if you go back to Asimov and his three laws, if you delve into them,
those laws themselves actually place the value of the robot less than the human, because, you know, they have to make sure that anything they do doesn't, you know, injure a human foremost. So I'm kind of interested in that aspect about whether we use robots just as tools. And if we are using them just as tools, you know, why do we make them look so much like ourselves? So that's quite an interesting aspect of it.
And even when they're not like ourselves, the movie Silent Running with Huey, Dewey and Louie, we have robotic life forms that, and clearly there are folk who would say, well, what about R2-D2 as well? Let's not forget the whole Star Wars scenario.
Or Johnny Five as well.
Precisely. I'm glad you got that little reference. Very good. All connected together with that whole zone of, again, the creation and that interaction in terms of how we connect with people. Is it something that's deep-rooted in our human psyches that we do need to connect?
I think it is. I think the way in which, you know, we form relationships with other humans, other people, is you know, we tend to gravitate towards people that have similar interests in us, act in similar ways to us. So if we want to work, you know, it's certain that robots are going to become more prevalent. You know, ever since the Industrial Revolution, we've been building machines to do our jobs and make our life easier and make things more efficient. And more robots are going to be seen. And as technology gets cheaper, the technology gets more efficient, gets better, gets smarter, we're definitely going to see a lot more of these around. So we're going to have to interact with these robots. We're going to have to work with them side by side. You know, you might be on a production line and your colleague to the left or right of you might be a robot. And how do you interact? Do you interact? If there's no personality in that robot, it's going to make your day very dull indeed. So we need to look at how humans form relationships and see if we can do similar things with robots.
I think we're only a matter of 6 years away from the centenary of Chapex Rossum's Universal Robots emerging. In fact, it was his brother Joseph who, in fact, coined the term robot. That was clearly written at the height of Fordism, the aftermath of the Russian Revolution. You can see so many parallels between the robots who, again, ultimately are sent out, banished into a new Garden of Eden to just go and sort themselves out after sort of realising that, unfortunately, the secret of reproduction had been destroyed in the play. No spoilers there, but it's a well worth accessing. Here we are a century later, thereabouts. Have we improved more from the point of view of, or do we still see robots as a threat? You mentioned in the production line, when does a robot stop becoming an asset and a trusted assistant and become somebody who's actually taking your job?
Well, to go back to just to coining the term robot, robots, I believe, came from the term worker, I think, is what it meant.
Absolutely.
And you know, we still view robots in that sense. They're still workers. They still do things, and it happens all the time. So you know, when we build new technologies, build new equipment to replace humans in the production line or in a job, you still need people to repair those robots. Mm. You need people to develop new robots. Mm. So it's not about replacing the jobs of people. I think it's about reskilling or refocusing where we work, where we focus. Yeah. So maybe if robots are working on production lines, it gives us more time to enjoy creative things, you know, be more creative, yeah, take up art, you know, and become generate a new Picasso or something. So I don't think it's ever going to replace people and make us redundant. I think what is going to happen is, as we see these machines in different situations, we're going to find people are going to reskill, retrain, and we're going to find new jobs and new roles that are going to be needed for individuals.
And of course, we'd be remiss. I mean, you mentioned obviously Data, and clearly he was exercising his painting techniques in various episodes of Star Trek as well. But let's not forget Chappie and Wall-E. We couldn't actually run this whole piece without Wall-E, or indeed Eva, because there's another case whereby, albeit Wall-E was left behind on Earth as a refuse robot, a refuse collector, and so on, as we progress into space, as we head towards the possibility of Martian occupation and all these areas which, you know, we've been promised for many years but seem to be on the cusp of kind of being developing, robots could be massive assets in terms of exploring and going even beyond the solar system.
Well, they've already done that, you know. So the Mars rovers, they're robots, and we've sent them out to make sure that, you know, Mars can be used as a place for sending colonies. The Voyager's now left the solar system and is now still sending data back, although it's going to take many, many years for that information to come back to
Earth. It's like contact. We'll get the signal from Vega before too long.
We will, yeah.
Let's move back to Lincoln Lights, because after all, that's what I mean. I think we've got a whole series that we're going to talk about here in terms of robots. But looking back to what Mark will be seen, or where will he be seen? Will he be sort of wandering around? Will it be a case of, oh, it's Mark, will he be surrounded by lots of robots and so on?
So Mark's got no legs at the moment. I don't want him running off on me.
Very good.
So he's static and fixed into one place. You'll be able to find him in the main building during Lincoln Lights. People can come along and interact. He likes to play paper, rock, scissors, so you can have a little game with the robot, see if you can beat a robot. He plays noughts and crosses. He plays a few other games as well. And you can interact. And there are going to be several other robots there as well. So we've got other humanoid robots. We've got more agri-tech industrial style things you can come and see. You can view the world through robots' eyes. You know, there's lots of robots being exhibited at Lights, but Mark will be there, and you'll be able to come along, take a selfie, interact, and have a conversation with him.
And I was interested, obviously, Mark has a nice sort of blue and white coloration from that perspective, which is almost Lincoln City's away strip, really, with the sort of sequence. But it's fascinating, of course. Deep Blue, the first robot that effectively won at chess.
That's right.
We progressed from thence. Part of Lincoln Lights history is to inspire, is to actually sort of acknowledge the whole sort of system. It's fair to say the line we've taken has been very positive for robots. Are there any caveats, would you say, that you need to... I mean, if we encompass your good self as being Noonien Singh, who obviously, for every data, he created law.
A law, yeah.
Exactly. Are there any areas we need to just have in terms of an ethical code or other elements? Or
None of my robots have injured me as yet.
Excellent.
Yes.
Or anyone else.
Or
through inaction, cause any upsetting things to occur from that point of view, which Indeed. Is good stuff. Finally, how can people actually find out more about Mark?
So again, if you go to the computer science website at the university, or if you simply Google Mark with a C, robot, Lincoln, you'll find all the information you need. And you'll also find videos of him opening schools in the Lincolnshire area, which he did. He likes to have little cameos here and there, and days out.
Lincoln, get hold of tech and science. It's Lincoln Lights. And the podcast series continues with some fascinating insights into the world of biofeedback with Professor David Mulliner, who's with us now. David, good to connect with you. How are you?
Very good. Lovely to be here.
In this particular aspect of Lincoln Lights, we see biofeedback technology improving sport performance. Now, we've often heard tennis players say that actually it's the mind that actually sort of creates the winners. It's the way people can actually control their aspects on this. Share with us your own interest in this field, and does this apply to all sports?
Well, that first part that you mentioned with the psychology, sport is multidisciplinary, so the biofeedback is just one element. And yes, it covers all sports.
And let's break it down. Biofeedback. Because people are aware of feedback in terms of NSS feedback, in terms of student surveys, in terms of traditional sort of way, in terms of radio station feedback and so on. Biofeedback, just how does it work for the layperson?
Just in terms of taking down the two aspects of the word, bio is biological, and in this instance we refer to that being the human body, and feedback is giving the information back.
So, literally, it's a case of what happens. Now, I'm mindful of the work of Claude Bernard and homeostasis and the milieu interior. Is it building on the work that's there? Because, I mean, our bodies are so wonderful in kind of sorting themselves out and keeping that balance. Is that an aspect that also you've been applying?
Oh, certainly. And there's, in terms of the history of biofeedback, it goes back centuries. Mm. But in... The difference now is the technology enables us to give that information in real time and a lot more precise. So when we measure the biological system, we're measuring to sub-millimeter accuracy, and then we actually just give that information back in various forms. And depending on the sport, it would be whether it's auditory or visual, and the auditory would be suitable for those that have to use vision for where they're performing, so they'd have to listen to auditory signals. But those that don't rely on vision, we can then actually start to give that feedback in a visual format.
We talked about all sports, of course, and Lincoln City have, thanks to the Cowley brothers, had huge success in terms of their elements from this point of view. But presumably this element that you're offering with respect to sports performance, it's literally for everybody, even to your average
fast walker, presumably. You can actually use the techniques of biofeedback to look at how they're actually performing.
Yes. What we try to do, because we integrate the technology, something that's quite simple that a coach could identify and maybe use some simple technology. If you wanted to know the speed of the foot when they were making foot contact with the football, we could use a radar device for that. But we try to go a little bit more complicated and try and work out how the body actually generates that speed. And so quite often that's how the hip, knee and ankle move in a sequence. And if they move in the correct sequence, you'll actually achieve a faster foot velocity. So we actually try to give feedback about that sequencing.
And is there a danger of almost overthinking the policy? Because athletes often talk about being in the zone and effectively getting to the stage of almost transcendentalism, where they effectively are constantly scoring well, making the actual shots, etc. How does the biofeedback kind of offset and enhance rather than possibly provide confusion for athletes?
The enhancement comes from, because we are such complicated beings, and again, I just focus on the movement sequence rather than the in the zone quite often refers to more the psychological mm-hmm. perspective. We find that they haven't, the system is complicated, so that if we let them try and self-organize, they get to a certain level of achievement, but then they can't get to the next level. And that's where we try to use the technology just to give them that direction. And what we do find is that they learn quite quickly, but they don't become dependent on the technology. So once we've shown them what might be a good way to perform a movement, they tend to, if we bring them back 5 months later and look at them again, they've retained that information without us interfering with them.
So it's a bit like a golfer having the right grip for the golf club, really, which I've always found a fascinating sort of exercise in itself, really, actually, how to take a golf club and actually hold it correctly. But from that point of view, what can people expect from the events that you're running with respect to Lincoln Lights? I mean, in terms of this, an activity that you're running which is suitable for people of all ages, what are the key things that they can anticipate?
So on the day, we'll be based in our biomechanics laboratory in the Human Performance Centre. So you go into the sports centre and then head off to the right, and then our laboratories are in there. And the biomechanics laboratory is an open space. It's like a small sports hall, about the size of a tennis court. And we'll have a number of cameras set up. And those cameras are, we have 17 of them. They sample up to 10,000 frames per second. So we obviously won't need that much data on the day. We'll probably be working at about 100 pictures a second. We then place small, what we call retroreflective markers. And the retroreflective means that light that comes from the cameras actually will only bounce back in the direction that it touches the marker, so it doesn't scatter across the room. And then we track those markers, and we track them to sub-millimeter accuracy. And once we track those markers, we'll then be feeding that into the symbol, into the computers. They'll generate some data, so we might measure the speed of your foot, as an example, if we're going to kick a football, and it will give you that speed in real time as a display on the screen, so people can interact with the system. And we might have some sort of competition to see who can get the
What would a sporting experience be without a bit of competition? You're literally getting hold of the technology and the science. Clearly, there's the lightsexpo.org, which is the website for all of our activities and so on. Is there a place that people can go to online, David, that perhaps relates to biofeedback technology from your own research perspective?
The easiest place is to find us on the university's homepage. So if you go to www.lincoln.ac.uk/sport, that will take us to our page. And then if you follow the research links, it will take us to the various research groups. And one of those is the biofeedback one, and you'll find information there.
And have you applied biofeedback techniques to your own sporting activities, or are you more a case of a coach and a manager and a sideline cooperator?
My own performances aren't brilliant. I try and improve other people's. But we apply it to elite sport, Paralympic sport, to industry as well. We're working in ergonomics and people fitting into cars, and work with animals of various sorts.
And that's
so
really,
anyone who moves, we can measure that movement.
Which is the next real question, because it's the applications. People who are listening to this are thinking, well, that's okay, but I'm more of a couch potato than an athlete. There are lots of other areas in which these techniques can actually be used to really maximise and optimise the best way forward, presumably everything from posture through to the most efficient way of effectively, again, running 100 yards.
Yes, and posture is another one where it's very simple data. Effectively, posture is measured by bathroom scales, but rather than having just one sensor in the bottom, you effectively could have four, one in each corner. And as you move your weight to each corner, you'd see the change in the posture underneath. And because that's a simple signal, that's one we can give feedback on very quickly as well. So if people want to stand steady.
Well, I think, again, from a serious perspective, this also ties into ensuring that you can minimise challenges to one's health and a good posture, making sure that you sort of sit correctly. Certainly, you know, within the academic world and the milieu, we're always told the 20-20 rule when looking at screens. You don't want to spend all your day hunched over a computer screen, tempting though it might be, because it's not good for the overall well-being.
No, yeah, you need to stand up fairly regularly, go and have a break, maybe have water rather than coffee, you don't have too much. But, you know, and that's also been modified as well, so people now started to use the stand-up treadmills with the desk in front of you, and there's some good evidence to show that being mobile while you're not so much sat
yes.
at a desk.
Yes, that is an interesting thing. I'm often struck by surely that's just one stage away from actually putting hamsters on wheels in a human form, really. But perhaps we'd best not go there. That's another line for innovations to work through. David, are there any other sort of elements relating to Lincoln Lights that you'd be interested in yourself, assuming you're not just locked completely into biofeedback technology?
Oh, yeah, there's so much going on in the university. Like what's going on in life sciences and what I've seen in art and architecture.
It's always nice to think about cross collaborations as well from that point of view. I'm sure that's a great way in which synergy can actually apply to apparently disparate ideas, creating a third touch of magic.
Yeah, and you know, there's collaborations all the time because we focus on measuring movement. So even if we just had a simple GPS system on someone, that links to architecture because they like to know where people like to move around campus, and you find out where people cut corners and where you need new parts. So the technology and the interaction between lots of different schools is tremendous.
Lincoln, get hold of tech and science. It's Lincoln Lights. And so we continue the exploration of the smorgasbord of science provided by Lincoln Lights with myths and science of sleep. And we're delighted to be able to share some moments on aforementioned myths and science of sleep with Professor Graham Law from the College of Social Science and the School of Health and Social Care at the University of Lincoln. Graham, a delight as ever. And we're both conscious.
Are we both conscious?
This is it. Are we astral? Are we astral traveling? Are we?
That's
simply
a very interesting question. Are we in? Are we in a simulation? One of multiple simulations? I don't know.
And this is part and parcel of that whole notion. As we've said, we hear tales such as Mrs. Thatcher. She never managed to have any. She 2 hours sleep, 3 hours sleep. Mm. That's all. Mm. What happened to Mrs. Thatcher, I have to say. But in terms of all of those aspects, sleep is something that's a bit like death and taxes. We will experience as being human beings.
That's right. Death and taxes. So we all definitely experience sleep most days. Most people sleep most days for, actually, on average, 7.5 hours is the average reported, self-reported sleep time for people in the UK and in the US and in Canada and in Australia. So westernised civilisations, Northern Europeans, we sleep for 7.5 hours. So Margaret Thatcher was renowned for sleeping 4 hours, apparently. I think the best reports are weekdays. She probably did have shortened sleep. However, weekends she caught up with her sleep debt, which is quite normal.
And of course, added to that, we've got the whole notion of deep sleep, REM sleep, alpha rhythms, the right kind of sleep, the suggestion that actually frequent cat naps during the day is actually better than a kind of long indoor sleep. Too much sleep. Are all these just myths that have kind of just grown up from that point of view? Or,
well, You've just touched on about seven or eight different myths in one or two sentences.
Exactly.
And let's think. You said catnaps. Okay. Socially, napping is seen as a thing that lazy people do or old people do. There's no doubt that's a set of myths. And
won't start talking about Spanish siestas.
Well, so in Northern Europe, there's no doubt that we see napping as being quite a negative. In fact, I was talking to a woman last week about napping, and she said, "Oh, I can't nap." What she said was, she said, "Oh, I find napping really weird, just lying there." And I said, "That's not napping, that's lying. If you want to nap, you need to go to sleep." And she couldn't believe that people actually did fall asleep for a nap. And there are four different types of napping, where you either basically you'll plan your nap or you're forced to nap because you're so tired. And there is some evidence that a planned nap every day isn't harmful. However, there is also evidence that suggests that people who extend the amount of sleep they have in a daytime through napping might be having an underlying illness. They might be unwell for other reasons, and so there's associations with a shorter life expectancy, for example. But I'm a strong advocate for a nap when you need one. There's something called, have you ever heard of the coffee nap? So the coffee nap is, and this is becoming a bit more popular. So the idea is you're feeling tired. You might have a post-dinner dip, circadian dip it's called, and you might think, right, I'm going to have a nap. If you then have a double espresso first, then lie down. It takes about 20 minutes for coffee to get into your bloodstream properly. So you've got a 20-minute window where you can take a nap. So have a coffee, go to sleep. After a good nap is about 15, 20 minutes long. Wake up. Then not only will you feel refreshed from having your nap, you'll also feel buzzing from having had a double espresso 20 minutes before. And that's a coffee nap. And there's a group of people who think this is a good thing.
Extraordinary. I mean, again, we're into that whole notion of where the meditation comes into play, how we kind of improve our wellness, and how, in essence, we've used the term before in previous elements and interviews, that sometimes, a bit like computers, need to switch off, start over again. Sleeping is part of the human organic experience of processing information and ensuring that we don't simply suffer from information overload.
Yeah. So if you ask a child why you sleep, they'll say it's to rest and recover. Now, the truth is you use about the same amount of energy whilst asleep as you do whilst watching television. So why in an evolution, why would a human being be programmed to shut their eyes and go into a state where you can't react if you're being attacked by a tiger or something? It just makes no sense. In an evolutionary way, it makes no sense. That there must be more to it than just resting. And it's not about resting muscles or conserving energy or conserving heat. None of these really work very well in terms of why you sleep. It seems that you sleep because your brain is really quite active. It's doing things, and there's very clear patterns of brain activity whilst you're asleep. And one of the important components of your sleep is that you're processing memories, that you're laying down the short-term memories into the long-term memory bank. And there's no doubt that that seems to be a very, very important role. It might be also that you're flushing out the metabolic slurry from the day because you're processing, but you're also taking there's a whole set of chemicals that are in your brain from a day of activity that you need to flush out. I don't like using the word toxins because they're not toxins, you produce them yourself, but it is a good pattern for your brain where you in the evenings at night you flush out these this waste products.
And by the time we're three, apparently we've slept for at least 10,000 hours, which means we should all be experts on sleep.
Well, yeah, by the time you're three, you've probably slept for about 14,000 hours. And if you were the Beatles, you have practiced your guitar for 10,000 hours. And if you're Bill Gates, you've practiced programming for 10,000 hours. And you become an expert.
Instant expert.
We are therefore experts at sleep. Yeah.
So let's move on to this particular Lincoln Lights event, 2017, of course, from this perspective. What can the attendees to Myths and Science of Sleep with your good self, Professor Graham Law, what can they anticipate or expect? Will it simply be a case of just bring your own duvet?
Well, I hope not. The plan is that you don't sleep whilst I'm talking, but you, of course you could, and I suppose it might be a win-win from that perspective. I think anybody attending should expect to hear about what people think about sleeping. We all have a whole mythology to do with sleeping, and I'm not going to tell you what these are because I want people to tell me what they think mythologies are. But in the work I've been doing, I'm now up to 55 myths recorded that people have told me about sleep. And so what we'll do is we'll allow people to tell me what things they think they know about sleep, and then we'll discuss that, because there's a whole science an evidence base for all of these things, and most of them are not true. Some of them have kernels of truth that might be useful, some of them are beneficial, some of them are just plain harmful.
It's going to be fascinating. How did you follow, was it a particular sort of time where you thought, I want to follow sleep, just from your own particular perspective, you know, within the medical sciences, it's such an important thing, sleep, for actually healthy and healing us. Yes. Was it something you'd always sort of felt, sleep is for me?
No. So 8 years ago, I up until then, I'd been working on general well-being, of course, and you're looking at things like lifestyle factors, smoking, diet, exercise, the usual sort of patterns of these are the things you look at. And you know, it was interesting. And then about 8 years ago, I was approached by somebody who we were working on something else, and she just mentioned in passing that she'd been working on what are called clock genes. And clock genes are, they seem to be one way that the cells in your body actually operate over a 24-hour period. And we were talking about that, and we got to discussing that we could actually look at sleep, and we realised that it is not a well-explored area of research at all. In fact, it's been a completely ignored area of research for a long time, especially in clinical medicine. So we decided to start looking at that. And when I then would talk to people socially in a cafe or at a party, it was so clear people were so interested in sleep. They would immediately say, "That's really interesting, Graham." And then they would tell me, "I only had 1 hour sleep last night," or, "Oh my word, my husband snores so badly, they wake me up all night." So there are all these stories about people's sleep. And I realised there was a real public interest in sleep as a thing. And so we started working on it. And of course, to really justify the money that goes into the research, I need to really show health effects or health benefits of sleep. So at the moment, I'm working on diabetes and sleep, which has some very clear links. But really, it's been since then I've been working on sleep.
Lincoln, get hold of tech and science. It's Lincoln Lights. Lincoln, get hold of technology and science, as the iGent actually goes, and we're delighted now to actually focus specifically on her own particular area of expertise with Professor Carenza Lewis, of course, Professor for the Public Understanding of Research at the University of Lincoln. A pleasure as ever, Carenza.
Thank you very much.
So let's talk, Lincoln Lights is with us. People might be listening to this on the day, they might be listening to it beforehand. Lincoln, get hold of technology and science. Your own particular specialism very much from the archaeological field, the historical field. Share with us what magical things you'll be bringing to the day itself.
Well, I'm going to have an exhibition on the sort of in the art and architecture building, far side of the tracks. And it's about the Black Death. And it's really there to explain to people how you can find evidence for the Black Death in anybody's garden. So there'll be, it focuses really on this technique that I've been using, which is 1 meter square excavations. So tiny little mini digs. And because they're just 1 meter square, you can fit them in anywhere. And I've had a program running for about the last 10 years now. We've done 2,000 of these 1 meter square excavations in more than 60 different villages. Farmsteads, hamlets, here, there and everywhere. And because we've got so many done, we can look at the stuff that dates to before the Black Death and compare it with the amount of stuff we get that dates to after the Black Death. And we can use that as a proxy for population. And the main stuff we look at is pottery, because it's what people use all the time. It's durable in the archaeological record, so we can find it, and it's easy to date without it being very expensive. So we literally count the number of pottery sherds for the couple of centuries before the Black Death, count the number of sherds for the couple of centuries afterwards, and the difference shows you changes in the number of people, given that people use pots, they don't walk around on their own.
It seems, again, an almost awesomely simple technique to actually employ, but a very effective technique to actually employ. I mean, I'm mindful it used to be used when back in the day when I was doing ecology studies of various buttercups, and you'd use that sort of square scenario. And that building up from the, almost the, not the microscopic, but from the micro to the macro and the deductive logic that you actually imply. Where did the whole strategy come from? Can we go back to when people thought, this is a good idea, we can apply this?
Well, it goes back to, as you say, that idea of working in open landscapes, really, where you kind of have a metre square and you decide where to put it, and there's a huge amount of debate about where to put it to get a representative sample. You might just throw your metre square grid around.
Totally random.
Absolutely, to get a random. Or do you have a stratified system where you decide where to put them? And that was very good for finding archaeological sites in open terrain, so out in fields or so on. About 20 years ago, Mick Aston, who some people may remember from Channel 4's Time Team, which I also worked
it
on.
It was, I mean, people said once, that particular era, it's the golden era of Time Team, Carranza, the golden era.
It was indeed, yes. Yeah, the first 10 years or so were fantastic. So Mick, with the stripy jumper and the wild white hair, he tried this idea of 1 metre square test pits in inhabited villages. Nobody tried that before. Everyone assumed it wouldn't work because everything would just be destroyed or built on, and you know, 1 metre squares are so small compared to a whole village. But if you do enough of them, you do get a pattern emerging. Mick showed this worked in one village in Somerset, and I then extended it to, as I say, 60 villages across eastern England, and we've done a couple in Lincolnshire now, and there are others in Yorkshire and Derbyshire, and sort of extending out into other areas. And basically, if you do enough of them, and you plot the data, you can see your settlement growing and shrinking and moving around over time just by plotting the presence and absence of pottery. And that's what this exhibition will show. It'll show people will be able to see what the pottery looks like. They'll be able to see examples of some of the maps and see the kind of before and after effect. And then some of the graphs as to how this actually works across the whole country. And the great thing is now, because we've got 2,000 of these pits, and we know what the average trend is. So we know, for example, that 40% of these 1 metre square test pits have produced more than a couple of sherds of pottery predating the Black Death, and only 20% produce same pottery after the Black Death. So it goes down from 40% to 20%. Mm. So any individual pit, you can compare it to that. So if you dug one pit in your garden, you could see whether, you know, if you get pottery predating the Black Death, you're one of the 40%. If you don't get any, that's unusual. If you get masses of pottery post-dating the Black Death, that's really unusual.
And in terms of those findings, have there been any areas where you have been surprised by the findings, or you thought, I wasn't quite expecting that? Because, again, clearly, culturally, that whole pre-Black Death, post-Black Death, a whole range of sort of elements within that. Were there any sort of notions where you thought, oh, that was unusual?
Yes, I mean, it's bizarre how some places that are really quite closely neighbouring will have very different patterns. So someone like Clare in Suffolk, for example, has about 50% decline, but you know, along Melford, which is only a few miles down the road, has a massive increase. And someone like Thorney in the middle of the Fens in Cambridgeshire has a massive increase, a 200% increase. And you wonder why that's doing so well after the Black Death when everywhere else is doing so badly. But, of course, it's not until you know what happened that you can start to think about why. If you don't know what happened, you don't know what you're trying to explain.
Is this a sort of phenomenon of history, certainly in the 21st century as we understand it, where we're also looking at causes and events and rationales from that point of view, rather than just simply the sort of ideological parade of dates that used to obviously be the case when people started talking about archaeology and history?
Yes, and I'm just writing a paper at the moment on the impact that the Black Death had on settlements. And there's some really interesting trends that we can see, that there seems to be many of the settlements which became smaller became more tightly nucleated. Everyone's living more closely together, and they seem to be clustering around the church in many cases. Not always, but in many cases, they seem to move closer towards the church.
Well, there is that line that if you've actually got a major disaster, it brings people closer to their God.
Well, you know, it's when we've seen the pattern, we can then start to try and think what might be the explanations for it. And the great thing about the period of the Black Death in the 14th century and 1300s is that we have historical writings from the time as well. So we've got more than one line of inquiry, more than one form of data, which means that any biases in one form of data hopefully will be corrected by not those same biases not being present in other data.
I love the phrase, the great thing about the Black Death, but obviously we qualify that by saying, I'm sure people are sort of looking through the view screening of history, so extraordinary the way we actually have this perspective.
Well, what I'd like, I mean, if people come along and have a look at this exhibition, just have a look at the stuff that comes out of the pits. We're going to have a big display showing stuff right through from the 20th century back to prehistory to give people an idea of what they might find if they were digging in their garden. But have a look at the pottery, because it's very unremarkable. It's stuff you wouldn't notice, and yet it has so much information in it. And that really is what the whole exhibition is about, and it's what the whole of Lights is about, really. There's so much information out there. There's so much to know and see and understand and learn from things if you just take a few minutes to find out what's there.
It's Friday, the 29th of September, of course, the great day itself. Whereabouts can people locate your talk, Corenza?
Well, we're in the Art and Architecture Building, which is on the south side of the campus, sort of near the St Mark's Shopping Centre area, just the other side of the road from that. It's the big, flat, white building that I'm in.
And if folk are sufficiently intrigued, not only by the talk itself, but also by what they've just heard on this particular podcast, is there a website where your research can be easily accessed in terms of finding out further details and information?
Well, if they go to my website at the university, so they just put my name, University of Lincoln, then that'll go to my page, and there's links to some of the papers there. They can go to the University of Lincoln repository, download it, and there's also the University of Cambridge has a lot of the data there as well, which is where I did a lot of this work before I came to Lincoln.